specific implementations, some actual projects that align with the plan, and really illustrate some of the recommendations in the plan itself. Now, we will focus not just on audio, but on media in general. That includes video and film, and that's because we all have video and film as well as audio that we need to deal with. So we're not going to differentiate for the purposes of this presentation. So you'll hear a talk by Josh Harris on the University of Illinois Media Preservation Census. You'll hear a talk on the Indiana University Prioritization Project that's campus-wide for media. And then you'll hear a talk from Chris Lasinic on really large-scale and highly efficient inventorying of media collections. That's what we got on tap for you. And we'll start with Josh Harris from the University of Illinois. Let me just grab my introduction. Joshua Harris currently serves as the Media Preservation Coordinator for the University Libraries, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he is establishing a formalized program to address the preservation needs of media collections throughout both the library and the campus at large through the Center for Multimedia Excellence. Josh received BA degrees in anthropology, archaeology, and history from Miami University of Ohio. In 1998, worked as a field and laboratory archaeologist for the Illinois State Museum and the University of Tennessee. In 2001, Josh joined the Smithsonian Institution, National Museum of Natural History, and the Department of Invertebrate Zoology, and in 2003 moved to the National Geographic Society Film and Audiovisual Archives. During his time there, he coordinated a diverse range of activities, managing staff and collections. Previous to Illinois, Josh was at the University of Kentucky, serving as lead designer of the library's electronic resource management system. Let's welcome Josh up to the stage.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much, Mike, for the introduction. And today I'm going to be talking to you about the University of Illinois' Campus Media Census. And start out just with a little bit of an introduction on how this worked, and we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty details and kind of look at then, towards the end, look at some of the outcomes and how this aligns with the Library of Congress's National Recording Preservation Plan. First slide here, you see on the left is a fellow by the name of Zach Berger. He was my man on the ground. He's surveying a collection there of quarter-inch audio tapes in the basement of the Illinois Press Building that had been languishing there for about 25, 30 years. And there's me looking at examining a collection in the Department of Chemistry of about 800 tapes that have been kind of unearthed through this process. So just a little brief introduction to the Library Media Preservation Unit. Some of you may or may not know that University of Illinois has one of the largest libraries in the country. I believe it's the fifth largest library in the U.S. behind Library of Congress, Harvard, I think Boston Public, and New York Public. It is the largest public university library in the U.S. and the second largest academic library in the U.S. behind Harvard. That being said, there's never been any person solely focused on media preservation, and that task was assigned to me in the fall of 2011. And it's a really a unique programmatic approach within the library focused on specifically on analog media. And it's getting into some digital stuff as well, of course, naturally. Part of my position also is on a seat on what's called the Center for Multimedia Excellence, and the survey directly correlates to the CME in that this is a campus-wide effort by media professionals to bring everybody kind of around the same table talking about how we can streamline and more effectively manage media both from pre-production all the way through production, and then, of course, archiving and preservation is my my angle. So this this census is part of an overall strategy to try to prevent the siloing of things on a gigantic campus of 50,000 students and, you know, 3,000 faculty and staff. So a challenge, no doubt. So what is the media census? You know, essentially it happened in two phases over the course of the past couple years. And the goal is pretty straightforward. It's to determine the extent of audiovisual holdings on the Illinois campus and collect reliable data on the extent of at-risk media, both within the library and outside of the library, being that nobody's ever focused on media within the library, just as much neat work needed to be done within the library system itself in order to get an idea of how we're going to strategize preservation moving forward. And of course, then to determine what our role as the library is in preservation across the campus. We hope that it's going to serve, and it will serve as a foundation for establishing an accepted time frame for the lifespan of analog media assets, and of course, you know, to provide a basis for the planning of short-term and long-term preservation and conservation strategies. And this, of course, directly, you know, segues right into planning for possible library services that would be rolled out campus-wide, so that as part of the campus-wide initiative, not just working to preserve individual collections within the library, because those may be deemed more important than others, but to, you know, identify and highlight prominent collections across the campus that have particular research value, cultural value, and may be held and need to be part of a overall strategy for preservation. And, you know, this is, of course, a follow-up to the inspirational work done by Mike and Patrick at Indiana University. And so we, of course, have to tip the hat to them for really getting the ball rolling and us, you know, coming and doing kind of using their work and the importance that census meant for their campus media initiative to likewise look at it at Illinois as well. So our census was done a little bit differently in that it was conducted over two phases. The first phase was a self-reporting web-based survey that was designed to collect a very broad range of information from a very general level. It was voluntary. It was sent out through numerous campus channels of informational channels, and you know, it wasn't just looking at analog media. That was a big portion of it, but it also was looking at still images, digital-born materials, anything that would fall under that category. Anything that would fall under the category of, you know, of non-paper, essentially. And the goal was to just to define a population of media holding folks out there. I mean, and the response was pretty good. Over 404 individuals representing 165 departmental units responded to the first survey. And it was, I think, by and large a success, although I'll discuss some of the issues that were raised by doing it this way a little later on. It didn't necessarily start out as a two-phase process. It was kind of, once the census phase one was done and examined in more depth, it really became obvious that two phases were going to be needed, and with the second phase being a deeper and more in-depth focus that had to be narrowed. The responses in phase one were just, you know, all over the map, and the total numbers of items ranged, of course, into the millions based on just the way that the census was designed. So we decided that a second phase was going to be needed, and it was going to have to answer, you know, we had to ask ourselves several questions, and one was really, do we include born digital items in this census? Do we include, you know, still images? And if we do include still images, where do we draw the line? Do we look at microscopic the microscopy images, X-ray images from the sciences. I mean, where do you, where, what's, in, you know, what, what's important is to one is not important to another. So we really had to look at that in depth and decide. And do we look at things such as playback equipment? Do we examine how much staff knowledge? There are things that might not be as easy to put numbers to. Staff knowledge, when you think about knowledge obsolescence and these types of things. Do we include faculty collections? Do we include emeritus faculty collections? Because you start to get into a very murky waters when you start talking about faculty collections. And so we had to, became another decision point. And then do we attempt to look at intellectual property issues? Do we try to figure out what's owned and what's not owned? And those were all questions that came up as we moved into phase two. And you know, we decided that, obviously, as you know by now, we decided to focus exclusively on analog materials, audiovisual formats, but also their digital derivatives. So to try to get an idea of how much digitization had been done already out there, and how much then needed to be done, or if a lot needs to be redone. And so this would represent, you know, to us, a population with a high degree of obsolete or obsolescence formats and playback devices, so what we're talking about as the most at-risk collection types. Though some may argue that digital, you know, is also highly at risk for various reasons, but it just was, it would become too much, too burdensome in the time that we wanted to do this in to start looking at digital collections. So we decided to follow the model that was done at Indiana as well, which was on-site, in-person interviews, where we, you know, did basic counts of formats and basic preservation assessments, by no means an individual inventory or an individual item level assessment of preservation of the materials. We did a, you know, assessment of the storage environments, and then, like I mentioned, a count and format of digital derivatives. We also decided to interview people about their audiovisual experience or their knowledge of audiovisual experience, of people with audiovisual experience. We decided also to look at how things were cataloged or recorded or not recorded. As you can imagine, that ranged from everything to nothing, from very in-depth to nothing. And then we started off with the desire that we were going to include faculty collections. That changed a little bit as we started to do the census, and we learned a lot about how difficult that was. We collected faculty collection information where it was volunteered to us, but we by no means went knocking on every door. We did, however, find early on that emeritus faculty are ones with are kind of floated to the top of the list because of their stature on the university research-wise. Most of them have well-defined sets of very defined sets of collections that are based on research, and their status as emeritus makes their collections immediately applicable as important research for the university, and may be coming to us in the and may be potentially donated to the archives in the future. And then we looked at evaluation based on the questions we asked of unique, rare, and commercial items. So how did we get people to respond to this? Various ways, mass emails, targeted emails, phone calls. I mean, I would say that Zach probably spent more time doing outreach and trying to get people to actually respond than actually surveying collections. We sent out campus-wide announcements, we made a brochure. I mean, it was really a heavy blitz to get stuff out there. Campus listservs, references, and word of mouth became one of the biggest. I think probably 50% of the respondents or people that participated in the census were just because we heard, you know, somebody said, oh yeah, Joe Smith, Jim, he has a ton of stuff down that basement, or talk to this guy, talk to that guy. we used the phase one data really as a Rolodex. It became kind of our, this is the place to start, and from there we will branch out. And you know, even people that responded in phase one were not exactly willing to let us in to get a real in-depth look. So, as expected, and by the way, all the photos in this presentation are from the census itself, so just a note there. So as you'd expect, analog media, wide-ranging, all formats across campus, wide-ranging storage conditions from, you know, moldy, dank, and dark basements to, you know, purpose-built, there's a couple purpose-built media vaults, but they're, you know, they still have their issues, of course, but they were at least intended to house media. And then, of course, a wide-ranging spectrum, content of high value and importance. A lot of that is based on the discretion of subject specialists. I wouldn't know that, those 600 or 800 tapes in Department of Chemistry mean anything, but the, you know, we're really relying on the subject expertise of people in these various departments because there's such a wide range of disciplines. Extreme variation in approaches to digital migration, as I'm sure you would imagine. I would say a very, very little of it, less than 5% would be considered anything preservation worthy. I mean, you know, it mostly transfers to CDs, to DVDs, MP3s, or low res, you know, things, even things done 10, you know, in the early days, real media, and things that just you would not require, you know, now would not think as preservation. And the census officially closed in the mid-March, but people just keep coming out of the woodwork, and that's something actually Mike had told me before we even started, that it's not a, there's never gonna be kind of a finite end. Once the kind of word gets out and things, people just keep coming out of the woodwork. So let's look at a few numbers. This data was as of February 22nd, and you know, we're looking at about 365,000 items here. High number of audio, as you can see, about 67%. Film, very small, and video representing about 28%. If we drill down on one of those, I chose audio since this is ARSC after all, we see that of the 245-ish thousand audio, you know, people identified 35,000 as unique, being this is the only copy that exists, this is the master, I know that I recorded it myself. Rare being ones that there may be only one or two or a couple out there, falls a little bit lower in the 20,000s, and then digitally migrated would be 70, like I said, it says 73,000, but it'd be more like 10,000, I would think even less. So based on the fact that people are coming out of the woodwork, since we dumped that data, about 65,000 new assets have come to light. I put the, you know, asterisk there being that we're still counting. So, you know, we are going to, as we develop the report for this, we're going to have to say this is the number right here just for the report, but that number just keeps ticking away. I checked my email earlier and it's like, oh yeah, I have this collection. You want to come check it out? So we did do a statistical analysis with the Department of Statistics, and, you know, based on the bias that we did, there was no way to confirm that this would be statistically valid as far as trying to project out from the number of departments that we had to the campus as a whole. We're talking 735 total departments. That's because we specifically targeted people that had media collections that we knew about. It was not a random sample. And there are pros and cons to doing it that way, and I'd be happy to talk more in depth about that. If you'd like, but the benefits of the approach was our goal. We wanted to find media collections. We wanted to contact people that we knew had collections, and you know, that gave us a more accurate account, and it also gave us an outreach point to people that have collections that are concerned about them, and a way to spark, you know, work on it. Like I said, the validation of phase one was difficult. It was tough getting in the door with a lot of people, and there was a lot of false, you know, there was not a lot, but there was a decent amount of false information on phase one because of lack of knowledge. 5,000 film reels that somebody recorded on the self survey, turned out to be 500 quarter-inch audio tapes. So, you know, that shows that the validity in the of going and examining this stuff in person. So the possible outcomes here we're looking at, in the short term, we really, you know, it gave us an ability to immediately identify, triage, and at least work with problematic collections. That's me in the parking lot. This is all from a collection of about 800 audio reels from an ethnographic collection recorded in Southeast Asia in the 50s and 60s. They're in terrible, terrible shape, but we're working on it. And that type of thing has really been a good outcome of the census in the short term. Other departments have been spurred into action just by meeting with us and learning about media preservation. I've been working with the Department of Landscape Architecture that has an incredible collection. And then just the immediate, kind of the one-on-one consulting with people during the site visits really opened up a lot of doors and really got people thinking about this as an issue. In the long term, we're looking at designing a media preservation studio in-house. The campus data will guide the formats, and the design will, you know, of course, have to be scalable and sustainable if it's to meet the needs of over 400,000 items, if we do all 400,000. What you see the pictures of here is the closet that currently contains our lab. I put a big X over it because I'm trying to tell them that's not an acceptable place to be doing media preservation work. And then we can provide, you know, how do we roll this out to the rest of campus? By providing the things that the library is known and that media preservation is good at. Working with people to develop their own collection inventories, and now how people analyze content and preservation assessments. Looking at storage of physical collections for the campus as a whole, and helping people develop procedures and all of these things. How do you write? Working with other departments on how to write grants for media preservation projects and how to advocate and do outreach to chemists and physicists and people that don't think about this stuff. But as we all know, the power of media can really grab people's attention once they see, oh my gosh, that's the first computer that was ever at Illinois' campus, and I worked on that, and it tugs at the heartstrings, and that's a great source of funding as alumni, you know. And then, there's obviously a clearly defined need for preservation level storage. Whether that's something that is worth doing or not is debatable. Right now we're keeping it in there, but we're really deciding, how that would work. And then we're also looking at how this could develop into institutional collaboration models, working with the Indianas and the other universities around us, pooling of resources, working to develop possibly umbrella contracts with vendors and, coming up with ways to maybe possibly have collaborative access points and helping others develop surveys of their own for their own campuses and bring this work to the attention of higher administration. So we were actually fairly delighted when the LOC's plan came out, because there were several points in there that were directly validated our work on the census and really confirmed that we were on the right, that we felt we were on the right track with this. Recordation 2.2 directly deals with the appraisal and surveying of audio collections. The census accomplished all these things that are listed in the LOC's report: assessment of storage conditions, a real count to the item level of assets, some knowledge about the ownership and provenance, the location of legacy equipment, knowledge, elevated awareness across campus. All of these things are happening and have happened as a result of the census. Recommendation 1.3 and 2.5 are things that we're working on as we start up the media preservation program and work on digital initiatives. We're working on I'm part of a team that's developing our in-house digital repository, which is called Medusa. I have no idea where that name came from, but And of course, this requires metadata standards and really building this thing from the ground up. And then 1.1 dealt with recorded sound storage facilities. Do we do this? Do we not? Do we have on or off-site storage? Do we have cold storage for campus? And how would that work with other collections across campus? That remains to be seen. And then finally, recommendation 1.4, you know, specifically talks about university courses and degree programs. And that's something we're really latching on to. We've been talking about using our lab as a learning lab, using our the media preservation unit as a place for new media preservation professionals to gain on-hands training. There's certainly enough collections to do to work with. And I think that could potentially create very good collaboration with other universities that already have some media preservation programs or library and information science programs. So I think, you know, using the lab as a learning lab is a really an idea that we're very very interested in. So thank you so much. And next up, we will hear from Mike Casey, and I'm going to do his brief introduction. Mike Casey is the Director of Media Preservation Services for Indiana University's Media Preservation Initiative. He is the co-author of Sound Directions, Best Practices for Audio Preservation, a contributing author to the second edition of the Best Practices publication, Guidelines on the Production and Preservation of Digital Audio Objects, also known as EASA TC04, and the creator of FACET, the Field Audio Collection Evaluation Tool. He also authored the Indiana University Media Preservation Survey Report and is principal author for the follow-up report, Meeting the Challenge of Media Preservation, Strategies and Solutions. He is currently adjunct faculty in the IU School of Library and Information Science, where he teaches a class in audio preservation. So I turn it over to Mike.
Okay, looks like we have it. We are going to talk about prioritization, and this is prioritization for digitization specifically. First, a bit of context for those of you who, many of you know this story already. For those that don't, I'll go through this very quickly. Back in 2009, Indiana University Bloomington published the results of a media preservation survey, which was very much like the census that Josh just got done describing. And we found that we had a very big problem on campus. Again, it's the same kind of problem that Illinois has right over the border there. That is, we have a lot of stuff, 560,000 audio, video, and film objects. You can see how they break down. In 80 units scattered across campus, carried on over 50 formats. So between this and the Illinois presentation, you get an idea of the magnitude of the problem that these big research universities face in trying to preserve media collections. While we were doing this, we were very much aware of our colleagues at the National Recording Preservation Board, who had stated that it's alarming to realize that nearly all recorded sound is in peril of disappearing. They said within a few generations, well, this is now a fairly dated statement, we would all say within a generation or less. We're also aware of our colleagues in YASA, our international colleagues, who are saying that this combination of degradation and obsolescence may in the end defeat our efforts. Again, this is a pretty old statement, we would now say in the short term. And so the university, on the strength of the census that we did, or the survey as we called it, initiated a year of planning. We're now in the third year of this one-year planning project. And the first year, which is good, actually, it's a good thing. The first year resulted in the publication of this report called Meeting the Challenge, which details some of our plans for long-term preservation of our holdings. If you want to find the Indiana reports, you can just Google Media Preservation and Indiana University, and you should get to our website. Perhaps the cornerstone recommendation from this report is to build what we call the Indiana Media Preservation and Access Center, or IMPAC, which provides digitization services to the campus. Well, on to prioritization. That gives you a bit of background to understand why we're prioritizing what we're doing. But we might further address the question of why people who are librarians and archivists, I think, intuitively understand the need for and the uses of prioritization work. But it takes some time. It costs resources. And some people will say, why prioritize? Just digitize everything. That's fair enough if you can figure out how to do that. But in addition to the fact that the national plan, as you can see in recommendation 2.2, suggests that we prioritize, we have some other reasons that make sense to our institution. One is that we have a lot of stuff. There's no guarantee that we're going to get through all of it. It's also no thinking that we want to get through all of it either, but more on that in just a moment. We have known degradation issues. Some formats are degrading rapidly. We have a very limited time window to transfer those. We want to know what those formats are, and we want to get them done as soon as possible. We have known obsolescence issues for some formats, particularly some video formats. That is becoming critical. The window to transfer 2-inch quad is closing, and it's closing fast, for example. We want to get those formats done right away as well. We have known high research value and known low research value. Obviously, we want to get the high research value items done in time. Our administration wants to see us prioritize. They've made that clear. They want to see us making choices. They like the fact that we're actively engaged with the collections and with the people who manage them. And they don't think that we should be in the business of preserving everything. There are no guarantees. Funding we hope will come our way very soon. Some funding already has come our way. But there's no guarantees that that funding will last. There's also no guarantees that the economy will continue to recover and will not go through another recession or depression, or that the will of the institution will remain steady in putting forward the resources to do this work. Therefore, we want to make sure that we get the highest priority stuff done at the beginning of our project. We don't think everything can be preserved at this point in time. Because of obsolescence issues for some formats, there's just simply not enough playback machines, not enough life on playback heads to do all the recordings that are out there. So choices are going to have to be made. And finally, and importantly, for us, prioritization is a parallel process with digitization. We don't have the time to wait for 2 or 3 or 5 years to do all of our prioritizing work, all of our planning to start digitizing. The time window is too short. The forces of degradation and of obsolescence are too critical. So we've already begun digitizing, and that is something that we plan to ramp up. Here's a high-level view of our prioritization scheme. Data collection, of course. But then analysis of that data in two basic areas. One, an analysis of research value. Second, an analysis of condition and risk. Bringing those two together, combining the scores from those two analyses to provide a ranking of collections. A curatorial review stage where the experts in the collections get to look at these rankings and move them around as they see fit. And then final prioritization ranking. Let's take a look at some of these very quickly. Research value. What is the value? How can we talk about or describe the value of media collections? With some conceptual work done by my colleague Patrick Feaster, who will be up here in a moment, we have analyzed some of the different ways in which media collections provide value in a number of different areas in a number of different ways. This analysis will be available as part of the software applications that Patrick will demonstrate that we'll be releasing later on this year. But we look at such things and discuss such things as research value, which I think is pretty well understood, instructional value. But what about experiential value, the idea that media recordings can help us experience certain events and other kinds of things in ways that other kinds of documentary heritage cannot, particularly paper-based documentation. Or production value, that is, the potential to reuse media assets in further productions. To help us analyze and rank collections by research value, we have created a software application called Media Rivers, developed first by the Sound Directions Project, now being taken over by the Campus Media Preservation Initiative. This was developed over the course of a number of years by a campus stakeholder group. You can see some of the units involved with that up on the screen. This is a points-based scoring system, very much utilizes curatorial expertise in providing its rankings. And actual software development of this application, we think we'll begin in June with AVPS out of New York, which is a consulting firm that's been with us since the very beginning of our project. Media Rivers, really, we're really bouncing off of some earlier work done in manuscripts, in the manuscripts world, by these organizations, some of them funded by Mellon, but extending it significantly further to be specific to media collections. The other area in which we do a basic analysis is condition and risk. This is degradation, obsolescence, the condition of the collection, characteristics that impact risk. And we've developed another software application called Media Score, which is a full-out collaboration with AVPS and Indiana University. AVPS is doing the coding, but the conceptual development was really a collaboration with both AVPS staff and with Indiana University staff. And this allows us to rank and score audio, video, and film collections. I thought I would just show you the scale upon which we place collections in terms of risk and condition. This is the media score scale. At the top of the scale is the extreme danger zone, as in digitize immediately. We have a very folksy way of thinking about how we take action with these collections, as in so only extreme cases find their way into this top category. But you'll find more collections in the danger ahead category. And there's our action statement. Or the caution category. And the lower end of the scale. Sad to say, we've not encountered any collections at the bottom there in the safe category. I don't anticipate we will for anything that's analog at the very least, or physical digital. But maybe there's something out there that's safe. We haven't encountered it yet. So the output of these tools, which Patrick will show you in just a moment, are filtered into a curatorial review stage where the experts in the subject matter of the collection can look at the scores and tweak those scores as they see fit, and also bring into consideration some other factors that software applications can't really deal with so well. Things like publicity needs, timeliness, or their anniversaries related to a collection that make it desirable to digitize it sooner rather than later, and on and on and on. The process is essentially a meeting between our team and unit staff. The analysis in the two basic areas that I talked about, the scores of which are valid within their unit only. We're not trying to compare the holdings of the Lilly Library to the Archives of Traditional Music, to the Music Library. What we're saying is that the impact, when it's built, will have the operating capacity to take all of the top scores, all of the high priorities on campus will get done. And with that, I'm going to bring Patrick Feaster up to talk about the nuts and bolts of how this actually happens. Let me introduce Patrick, give him the benefit of a formal introduction. I think we can now say president of ARSC. We can add that to his salutation is perhaps President Feaster now, President. Congratulations. Patrick is a researcher and educator specializing in the history and culture of sound media, a two-time Grammy nominee, co-founder of the First Sounds Initiative, author of Pictures of Sound, 1,000 Years of Educed Audio. He's been actively involved in locating, making audible, and contextualizing many of the world's oldest sound recordings. He received his doctorate in folklore and ethnomusicology in 2007 from Indiana University of Bloomington, where he is currently an adjunct lecturer in the Department of Communication and Culture and a member of the Media Preservation Initiative. Patrick, come on up.
Thank you. So I'd like to do a couple of things today. One is to explain the basic process of what's going on the ground at Indiana University as we tackle this task of prioritization, and also to show you how these two specific tools fit into it, Media Score and Media Rivers, and I'll show you what those look like and talk a little bit about how we're using them and what they can do. But getting back to the general process, we start off in the case of each unit, and we're currently dealing with a list of about 80 units from our initial survey. We start off with an initial meeting, which we set up with some representative of a unit. This serves a number of purposes right from the beginning. On one hand, these are often people that we met with during the survey back in 2008 and 2009, but perhaps they haven't kept track of what's been going on since then. So we give them a summary of developments since then, the various reports that have come out, leading them up to where we are today. So just giving them a sense of where we are, where things have gone since the survey. Or in some cases, of course, we're dealing with people who are new and weren't there for the survey. We give them an opportunity to ask any questions they may have about what's going on, what it means for them, and so forth. So this is an opportunity for them to raise any questions, voice any concerns. We discuss those. And by the way, I should say when I say we, it's myself, but also three graduate assistants, Jason Evans-Groth, Asia Harmon, and Josephine McRobbie. We refer to ourselves as the SMART team. There are a lot of acronyms involved in this line of work, and I tried to write down all of the ones that we're dealing with today so I could remember them, but I'm trying to remember what SMART team stands for. Mike, can you refresh my memory? I know it's something like Strategic Media Access Resource Team? Okay. We may be a SMART team, but keeping track of the acronym itself may be slightly beyond us. Anyway, it's the four of us who are doing really all that I'm going to be describing here today. So first of all, explaining where we are, giving them a chance to ask any questions they may have, and then starting to strategize about what we're doing means specifically for them. And the first thing we need to do in terms of strategizing is to talk about defining collections. As Mike has emphasized, we're dealing with over 500,000 items. So not only do we need to prioritize, we also need to group. We're not going to go through and individually think about every single item. We need to form some kinds of groupings that make sense. And in a number of cases, a unit already has its holdings grouped into collections of some sort. It's just that's the way they keep track of things. The Archives of Traditional Music, the Center for the Study of History and Memory, the Lilly Library, they already have things organized into collections, and when that's the case, we run with those. It's not always the case, though. Even in some of these cases, we may sometimes choose to group a few collections together for convenience. The important thing to keep in mind here, though, is that a collection for us has a very practical purpose. It's a grouping that makes sense to evaluate as a group. It should have some kind of coherence to it. It should make sense to think of it as a group based largely on content, on what this material has in common in terms of how people might use it. The material within the collection should have similar value. If it doesn't, it doesn't really make sense to use these groupings to rate things higher or lower. But in any case, we often have groupings like this already when we go in. We use those when we can. In other cases, we have to come up with groupings, and we might sit down during our initial meeting and talk about what those might turn out to be. Depending on the size of the unit, we may not need a great many groupings. But it varies a great deal by unit. What types of holdings, we ask, would you tend to think are worth more than other groupings? And so we have a conversation. You can see here a few of the categories we've come up with at various units. As you can see, the rationale for the groupings varies widely from case to case. The law library, for example, came up with categories based largely on types of events that they had recorded. The public health library tended to gravitate towards certain types of subject matter that they thought was more or less important for what they did. But the important thing is to form groupings that make sense locally. And once we have our rankings, there are these two different stages of, or two different facets of ranking that Mike has already talked about, one having to do with value, the other having to do with risk. And the one that we start talking about most immediately is this question of value, because that's the ranking that we really need feedback or input from experts at the unit to make the calls for. We sit down, we discuss the relative merits of the different collections and ask them to think about how they might rank relative to each other. But we also try to provide some structure to this process. Now, you can imagine setting somebody down with an individual collection and saying, okay, take this collection. Where would you rank its research value on a scale of 0 to 5? Well, it would be a little bit difficult. I can imagine a lot of people might do something like this. It's, well, this collection is, people haven't used it a whole lot, but it seems like it could have a lot of potential, and maybe people aren't using it because they don't know about it. And it's not a topic that's really well known, but it does a really good job, and the documentation is a little spotty, and a lot of things to juggle. And I think it would be very difficult for many people to keep all those things in mind, and also to remember to try to keep all of those things in mind consistently. And so we have come up with a structured way of leading people through this process, not to dictate to people what's important, but to make sure that they've thought through this in a structured and consistent way for the various collections that they're rating. I should emphasize that we've come up with these, it's really five fields that we rate. And these aren't something that we came up with lightly. I don't certainly want to go through the details of what I have up on the screen here, but this shows several different phases that the system has passed through over the last several years. Just to impress on you that this has run the gauntlet. We've tested a number of these systems, and what we've come up with today we feel very good about, but these are not categories that we've come up lightly. One thing that has been an enduring challenge is to come up with a set of fields for rating collections that are flexible enough to fit as many types of collections as we need to deal with, which could range from ethnographic field collections to, you know, athletics, recordings of football games or something like that, but that still is useful, that actually helpfully structures the process. So these are the fields that we came up with as a result of this process. And these five fields, for each individual collection, we rank on a scale of 0 to 5. Again, as Mike has emphasized, these are ranked within a unit only. So it doesn't really matter so much whether a 4 means the same thing in one unit as it does in another. It's really a matter of ranking collections relative to other collections at the same unit. And also, there's no motive to giving all your collections a 5. It won't help. Subject interest. This is how much interest is there in the topic of the collection, the subject of a collection, however you define that. How much interest is there just in the topic, in the subject? Secondly, content quality. How well does the collection speak to whatever that topic is? And these two fields speak to each other. They kind of fill in the gaps between themselves. Let me just give you an example, a couple of examples to explain how these work. So for subject interest, you might have a collection on a burning topic of the day. These are actually examples I use as I explain these things to people at units. Say a collection that's all about gun control. There's a hot topic. A lot of people would be interested in gun control. But if the collection just consists of a set of PowerPoints of undergraduates talking about gun control, yes, it may be a very interesting topic, but this collection doesn't do a whole lot for it. Or a specific collection that we evaluated at the Center for the Study of History and Memory. It's a collection that, it's an oral history project dealing with an organization for people who owned and operated roller skating rinks. So this is a topic in which there is likely not huge interest. There may be some interest, I expect there is, but not really a burning leading topic of concern, we believe. On the other hand, this collection does a very, very nice job of documenting that particular subject. So in that case, subject interest perhaps not so high, content quality higher. So that's how those two fields speak to each other in our scheme. Rareness is a third field we track, and in here we're not really talking about rareness in the sense of collectability, or even rareness in the sense of something being an absolutely unique recording. We keep track of that elsewhere. It's really for whatever you could imagine someone using this collection to accomplish, how easy would it be for them to find other material that would do the same thing for them? So rareness in that sense, how indispensable would this material be for somebody who wanted to tackle whatever the collection might conceivably enable them to do? Documentation. This doesn't treat the collection itself as documentation. This is really talking about ancillary materials that, on the one hand, let you know what's in a collection. Are you dealing with a box of audio cassettes with no labels on them? You have no idea what's there. That would be a very poorly documented collection. You might have a collection where all of the items are identified to a certain extent. You have names and dates and some account of contents. That would be adequate documentation. But it can get even better. We have certainly collections where you have reams of additional material, field notes, complementary descriptive material that augments the value of a collection. So those are really the poles that we're evaluating things as to where they fall between here. You know, a collection that you can't even identify versus a collection that's not only well identified, but it has a lot of extra material that enhances its value too. And finally, technical quality. How well is the thing recorded? So you might have an oral history interview that would score very well in all these other areas, but if it's so poorly recorded you can't understand what the person's saying, that would still rather catastrophically compromise its value. Like I say, each of these gets rated on a scale of 0 to 5. All the technical quality, you have the option of choosing unknown, and if it is the case that something hasn't been played back, we may not know that. They're rated slightly differently. The first three we feel are more consistently important. So they each get a quarter of the final score. Documentation is 15%, technical quality 10%. We also track two fields that are not scored at all. One is generation, that is whether something is a copy of an original and so forth. The other is IP status, that is whether something's restricted in its use or not. One reason we don't score these fields is because there are different philosophical takes on them. You know, whether a collection is well documented or not, I think people would be in generally common agreement that more documentation is better. But you know, a collection that you can't put up online right now, a curator of a collection might feel that makes a collection less attractive to do immediately, or they may say, this is a temporary condition, we still need to preserve this. So, but still, it may be something that people will want to track, so we do keep track of it in this tool. This is the actual tool that we use to do this. Right now, it's an Access database designed and built by Susan Huyenga, who's here with us. Eventually, this will be a self-standing software tool. But essentially, you see there's some administrative information at the top, a place to fill in each score. as we typically will sit down with somebody from a unit and talk through each collection in turn. Occasionally we have a unit that will furnish us with numbers that they've gone through on their own, but usually we sit down and walk people through this. A notes field where we can explain what our rationale was, particularly useful if we feel new information might turn up later that would lead us to reconsider our thoughts. And then the unscored fields, and finally the resulting collection score. So we work through that tool. For each collection a unit has identified, we come up with a numerical score. Do we believe that named lecture series at the law library with we can rank their research value with scientific accuracy to three decimal places? No, but we do believe that this ability to order collections does reduce the risk of getting to the wrong things. So that's really the right way to think about this, I think. Then there's the physical inspection, though. On top of value, we want to get at which collections are at most imminent risk. This part, we don't necessarily need to have members of the unit there with us for this. We do need their input desperately for the part I just described for you, but for this, really the members of the SMART team, we can do this on our own time. And here we are linking the information that we gather based on looking at the materials to the types of collection that we have evaluated using these other tools and that we've defined based on content and so forth. Occasionally, we may do these things in different orders, just depending on what's there, what we need to do. For example, we may have a unit that doesn't know what it has so well, so that by going through and creating an inventory, we can then sit down with them and they can decide what falls into what grouping, and then we create our groupings after we've done this. Or in some cases, we have collections that are spread over multiple boxes in remote storage. We find it makes more sense to go through the boxes in order and then group them into collections later. But the ultimate destination for all this information that we're gathering is this tool, MediaScore, which we've designed in connection with AVPS. As Mike told you, MediaScore, selection, condition, obsolescence, and risk evaluation. This is a self-standing tool we access through the web. It organizes data at three different levels. We start off at the level of a unit. Here you can see a list of the units where we've already located or actually already made entries for. Then by collections, again, this is the same type of grouping that I've just been talking about, the same groupings that we'd be keeping track of in Media Rivers. But then also the asset groups, that is within a collection, what different types of media are we dealing with that may have different risk factors associated with it? For example, is part of this collection on acetate tape, part of it's on audio cassette, and so forth. So we want to treat those things separately. We also want to be able to tell later on which items fall into which of these categories. Occasionally, items are not numbered at the unit and so forth, so occasionally we find ourselves numbering them so that we can keep track of what items fall into what risk groups and which are fall into other groups. So we have a certain coding system here that we've come up with for use in that case. But then for each asset group, there are certain things that we fill in. Some fields are the same for any format that we'll deal with. Things like quantity, generation, year recorded, duration, very important for us to keep track of for workflows down the road. And then some fields that are unique to particular formats. So for example, you see the fields that we fill in for polyester open reel tape. We have a checkbox for soft binder syndrome. We wouldn't have that for, say, a lacquer disc. So these are very customized. This then will generate a score that we can bring into connection with the score that our other tool gave us, and that will give us our final numerical rating that then goes on into the stage of curatorial review. So those are the tools that we're using, and that's more or less the process we're using them as part of. happy to answer any questions about that later, but at this point I'd like to turn things over to Chris Lisinek, founder and president of Audiovisual Preservation Solutions in New York City, and he's already come up frequently, but he'll have some more to talk to you now.
All set. Great. Thanks. Wow, that was a couple of great presentations to follow. So I'm going to talk about something in the same vein, but also very different, with kind of different intentions and purpose and outcomes. I'm going to talk about large-scale inventories, item-level inventories, and I'm going to use a recent project that serves as a case study for this to talk about that. So we're going to talk today about, sorry, let me use this, New Jersey Network, which was an organization that produced content broadcasting both to New Jersey and nationally, member of NPR and PBS, from the 70s to the 2010s, producing all kinds of stuff, a daily and nightly news program, long-form documentaries, a number of long-running series. They were the largest, well, one of the largest, if not the largest, public media station that produced content in-house. So lots of public media stations like WGBH or WNET are known to be the largest producers, but they use outsourcing with production companies and stuff. New Jersey Network had most of this work in-house. So they had a tremendous amount of content that they had produced. So why am I talking about them in the past tense? Well, in 2011, this came up in the news a lot. You may go, oh yeah, I remember that. And Chris Christie took a big hit. June 30th, 2011, or just a couple of days before, actually, it was announced within NJN, you don't have a job anymore. It's been defunded. Now, there was a political battle going on, but this happens every year. People were used to this. It comes up all the time, particularly around election years and stuff. And so, you know, a good portion, most people at New Jersey Network thought, that would never happen. That would be crazy, right? Until they got notice that they no longer had a job. So they went in a day from hundreds of people to five people, under the auspices of New Jersey Public Broadcasting, which was put intact to basically manage the wind down and ongoing operations that they knew would have to take place. Obviously, you say, well, how could that happen? There had been all these it was known to be going on, but they coordinated with stations like WNET for television, or WNYC and WHYY for the radio to take on the ongoing broadcast and operations for this. However, this caused a total blackout as far as the archive was concerned, right? You'll see images in a moment, but just imagine for a second a production environment that also has archives stored in multiple locations, where there is a large staff that is actively engaged in the ongoing, daily, and very active and lively caretaking of these collections, to everybody just getting up and walking out the door. We walked into this place, people's sport coats are on, their lunch is still out, their computers are still on. This was a year after, right? So people literally just got up and walked out. Think about that for a second. In with your collections, I mean, what that poses actually is that if there was zero institutional knowledge and somebody had to come in and piece together the collection that exists, right? That's a serious thing to think about. So what this blackout left them with? Okay, we've got operations under control. They didn't skip a beat. The morning news show still runs today for New Jersey. They got operations running for production and broadcast. nobody noticed, as far as what showed up on their television or radio, what had happened. But for the archive, it was a totally different story for multiple reasons, right? Because it's not only the significance of the collection, but by the way, they have to move out of this building that they've been occupying. Oh, excuse me. And so it's taking up real estate, and they have to do something with these collections. So they had no ability to articulate. There was no item-level inventory. As is typical, what happens in a lot of environments like this is that there are systems like scheduling systems and stuff like this that speak to the work level. So it would be about something that would air, right? But around that one broadcast master that was going to air, or that piece of content that was going to air, there's tons of production elements, there's tons of generations, there's a lot of content around that. And so there was no item level documentation. They couldn't talk to anybody about how much it was going to cost, what they had, how many things they had, what to do with it, what the preservation and access plans were, this is actively accessed even outside of the organization itself. Lots of people access these collections. So they were literally in a blackout. No ability to do technical planning, operational planning, anything around this. All in the face of, what Mike talked about, the 10 to 15 year, we call it 10 year kind of window in which to act if they actually want to keep this. Which brings up the point that they face, immediate accessibility issues, not to speak of long-term issues, and the potential permanent loss of an insane amount of content speaking to New Jersey culture and politics, national culture and politics. I mean, it is just a wealth of information. So no ability to access and distribute now or ever if they don't take action. So the New Jersey Preservation Board, I wish it was the Preservation Board, New Jersey Public Broadcasting put together an advisory board, part of which, was WNET was on that, and they went out and did some advocacy, raising awareness, talking about these issues and what needed to happen, and they got funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to put together an inventory and to get a recommendations and a report to do preservation planning. So we bid on that project and we won the project. What we knew at the point at which we bid on the project was very little. We had no information. All we knew is that they gave over 100,000 items. We had no idea what the makeup was. We knew that there was multiple locations. We didn't see images. We didn't see anything about it. But we knew that they wanted the output of a preservation plan and an item level inventory. What we discovered when we actually won and went to our first meeting was pretty eye-opening. And I'm going to show these images, and this is not to be disparaging at all to NJN or to NJPB. The people who stayed on are very passionate long-term. They've been there for many years and care a great deal about this collection. So I'll explain a little bit about why you see what you see. This looks rather good. So the range was, from highly organized, high-density storage to totally not organized and all over the place, right? So you ask, why does this look like this? They didn't rampage before they left and then go. So the state, over the course of a year, says, geez, we need cubicles in this place. Where are we going to get those? Well, NJN has them. Let's go pull them from there. So people come in, they pull stuff out, they dump out drawers on the floor, and leave and take it out. So this says, over the course of a long period of time, we have things that look like this, which is great, and we have things that look like this. So from individual items on shelves to stuff on the floor, and this is across multiple floors. Some, the better looking stuff is the archive. This kind of stuff is like producers' offices and production spaces and things like that. So a real mix of environments. But this gives you some sense of what we saw when we walked in. This is pallets that came from another location. These are, it's hard to tell perspective-wise here, but that's a lot of media there. and offices like this, like I said, you know, stuff had been dumped out all over. A wide array of programming types, and like I said, production environments, so lots of production elements to be sorted through and to figure out. So a question comes up is, well, how do you tackle a project like this, right? And this is my interpretation of a traditional approach to trying to do this, right? So what do we have here? Well, we have multiple people, four different, you know, each quadrant here, doing their own thing, often using different methods. So this person's using, you know, one spreadsheet application, this person's using another. This person doesn't like using and typing directly into a computer, so they're going to write it down and then transcribe it into the computer. And this person doesn't like computers, so they're just going to write it down. And you're off in the stacks, you're on different floors, you're not communicating. This is representing disconnect. It's a very isolated experience that doesn't allow people to engage and collaborate, which means that there's not immediate feedback to do things like make sure that there's consistent data entry, controlled input, there's not a lot of review. We deal with outputs of these types of projects all the time at AVPS, and I can tell you that it is really challenging, not always user error, a lot of times system error. People port things around, Excel behaves badly, you know, takes off leading zeros from identifiers, changes date formatting, does, you know, any number of things can come up that make this a really challenging scenario. So there's lots of QA and QC challenges here. It's very expensive. This is a very expensive way to do it. It doesn't optimize expertise. This person, scratching their head there, needs to know care and handling of media. They need to know how to identify these things, right? Like Josh pointed out, they can't call a reel of audio tape a film reel. That would be bad. And they need to be able to catalog. They have to know what, you know about controlled vocabularies. They need to be thinking about how to catalog strategically. So you're not able to optimize expertise in this way. So we had been thinking about that for a long time, and we've done, going back to 2006, collection assessments and surveys and inventories. We've did a project with the Department of Defense that was a global project where we surveyed over 1.5 million items. We're working on another project now that's 1.5 million item survey. We've done lots of inventories. And so we were very aware of the need to come up with some better, let's advance the state of what was going on with inventories and surveys. And so we came up with, this was a diagram we created for a proposal to the American Archive when they set about a project to do inventories across the country of public television and radio stations. So we put in a proposal saying, we want to do them all, which we didn't get, unfortunately. But and this is our approach. And so, you know, this kind of spells out some planning at each site. You have photographers on site, which I'll get into in a moment, that take images of the media. It's uploaded to a remote server, and you have remote catalogers that are cataloging from those images. You can incorporate centralized management, quality control, and quality assurance. It just gives you a lot more, I'll get into this later, but a lot more ability to create a more effective and efficient flow. So this is a little update to that. In a lot of ways, it says the same thing, but I'll get more in depth here. So, you know, with NJN going in, the initial planning is a huge logistical challenge, right? You have all multi-floors. You saw the state of affairs. I don't have to explain it. But step one is mapping and organizing, right? And that takes it's a big effort. It takes a lot of planning. You have to be thinking ahead, and you have to think about feeding people who are going to be photographing this stuff. So we have photographers. They set up stands. They're working next to each other, so they're, while they're working, they're able to collaborate and talk about what's going on, what they're seeing, what types of things are coming up. These are people that are trained in care and handling. In this case, we had a couple of employees that were former NJN workers, which was great. But you know, these people don't. In this case, they did know how to identify media, but they don't have to do this. So the photographers image at minimum the case and the media and anything that has any relevant information. So any label, any handwritten thing on any part of the case or the media, and in any pieces of paper or anything that's inside of the container is all imaged. The photographers are not just doing this freewheeling and wandering about. The manager has mapped out the entire space. They've identified sections. They're allocating specific areas to photographers to tackle. And so the photographers, it's a highly systematic way in which the photographers are feeding the manager these photos, which are then uploaded, in this case, to a central server. We're using Catalyst, which is the application that we've developed to manage this workflow and to do this. So within Catalyst, the manager on this end is getting records, is assigning them to catalogers. So they're getting, when this comes in this case, formats were identified upon upload. So the manager, it's nice because the manager can have some discretion if there are catalogers that have particular strengths. You know, they know certain media types better than others. They can allocate as they see fit. And catalogers are cataloging. When they're done, that work is quality controlled. And you have the other great thing, which is a centralized system with controlled inputs, right? So there's controlled vocabularies, and where there aren't controlled vocabularies, because there's lots of places where that just don't work for controlled vocabularies, you have immediate feedback. So this is, you know, this is all real time. The manager's able to see what's going on. People ask questions because they're sitting next to each other. Hey, how are you handling this? What did you do? I got this weird scenario. There's a lot of kind of collaboration and engagement and team building that goes on here. And the manager, you know, this is giving feedback constantly. So there's a very tight loop that makes this much more effective. The other thing is that the value of the output. What's a tradition? There is, in a traditional method, someone goes in, they document this stuff, they come out. How do you QC that? You can't. You're not going to go back in there and check their work. So you hope that they got it right. You hope there wasn't some mishap where they accidentally copied and pasted and then cut something out, right? So that's a huge issue. Now, what this also gives you is the ability, because you have the images, to do an iterative approach to cataloging. You can do a minimal amount across a large portion. Use that information to then hone in on the sections that you find more important and do more in-depth cataloging as it makes sense. So as Mike talked about the need for a prioritization of digitization, I think there's a major need for prioritization of cataloging. And this gives us a method to do that. And we don't have to go into the stacks to pull anything out. We have the images, unless we need to do something with that piece of media physically. We have all the information we need within those images to come back and do that. And we can use those images for quality control. Someone else can look at that and say, did they enter that in the same way that I would have entered that, or did they do that correctly? So a huge advantage there. So let's get down to business. So what did we get with the New Jersey network? This is basically what we had 4.5 full-time equivalents. Not everybody was full-time, but it came down to 4.5 full-time equivalent photographers that were imaging 400 items a day. So this is not 400 images. We had lots of images per item, but 400 items per day. We had 8 full-time equivalent catalogers that were doing 225 items a day. Over the course of 4 months, the photographers started about a month in advance of the catalogers. And so they each spent about 3 months doing this. We deaccessioned about 20,000 items because they were either non-state-owned assets or they were things like lottery, which they had the agreement had expired for which they needed to keep these tapes for the lottery, right? So let's see, is there anything else I missed there? No, that's the statistics we came up with. So about 110,000 items, 3 months basically, or 4 months in total, but 3 months per group of people. So, how's my time? What do we got? Anybody know? All right, well, I'm going to keep going. You tell me when you find it. So, I'm going to see how this is going to work. I want to show you Catalyst a little bit. 5 minutes. All right, so I'll make it very quick. What's that? All right, great. All right, you know what? Actually, maybe what I'll do is not show, that's not nearly enough time to show this. So I'm happy to show you, but I want to talk a little bit. Let me talk about next steps first, and then we'll go into. I'm happy to show anybody the system later. But what are the next steps for a New Jersey network? We use this information. We generated a preservation plan with recommendations and budget numbers and all sorts of things, and we've just given that to them actually this past week. They're going to use that to continue to do strategic planning, figuring out partnerships, how to navigate this, you know, challenging but important effort to the benefit of the public, really, to make sure that this is not lost. And we've been working, that was very early on, we started talking about the need to develop strategic relationships, and they've done a great job of continuing to explore that. So we now have some, you know, as we're doing this planning, we're actually using some of these potential partners and thinking at a lower level about how that would actually work, which impacts costs and operations and all this stuff. So it's been a very valuable exercise to do that. For Catalyst and for ABPS, what are the next things that are coming? Well, the one thing is that we're exploring the option of open sourcing this somehow, because I think it's something that would be very valuable to the community, and it ties in with some other efforts that we've been interested in around collaborative cataloging, trying to help overcome the challenge of, you know, you can't get funding unless you can articulate what you have, but you can't articulate what you have until you get some funding to do the work, right? So if people can have a way to do this cost effective at low or no cost, then all of a sudden we can overcome a hurdle that will be beneficial for everybody. The application itself, we're interested in incorporating some things around gamification. Like, we want people to get feedback, right? So I was, you think about in the Obama campaign, the call, if anybody did that, which I didn't love that experience, but I used the calling program they had, and while you're doing it, they say these messages pop up. You've done 5 calls, do 10 more, you know, way to go. These types of motivational things that tell you what your statistics are as you're doing it, that keep you engaged. You kind of do some goal setting. How many things can you do in a day? Maybe, you know, you're getting reporting and constant feedback about this stuff. It helps people stay engaged in a process that can be really challenging from a psychological perspective, to just do this constantly. It feels like a machine. So I think figuring out how to keep people engaged helps with quality control, but it also helps with just, you know, people being happier about the work that they're doing. My personal goal is to get this to under $1 per item. Costs, I think that the next things we're going to explore to try to figure that out is to lay this over top of like crowdsourcing applications, which there are some serious, you know, it's I think a potential high risk, high reward exploration. So we might look at something like Amazon's Mechanical Turk or Crowdflower. There's lots of these things where people sign up to do activities, I'll call them, but you can kind of, this is widely used in, you know, scientific community to do research or polls and stuff like this. So you allocate a certain amount of funding, there are people who sign up to do things, and so you could have people actually doing some cataloging of things, which you'd say, that's crazy, people can sign up. Well, you can do lots of quality control. You can vet who comes in. You can give them a quiz to make sure that they do media identification. You throw in bad information into the system, controlled variables to make sure that they don't come out the other system without getting caught. You do double or triple data entry. There's lots of things you can do to try to do that. So I'm very interested in seeing, because I think that's a really key way to be able to do this. And maybe that's not a replacement. Maybe it's a supplement to the normal way to do it. But I think that's a very enticing opportunity that may exist. And again, that might be just for the very minimal first layer, where then we could bring in people that are, you know, more professional catalogers and have subject area expertise to do the more in-depth cataloging. So I'm gonna leave it there. And I guess if we have time for questions, we can all take questions. Great, well, thank you.
Well, we had a lot to say, and we're out of time for questions, but here's what we're going to do. I will release you to your break, but those of you that have questions, come forward, and the group of the three or four of us, We'll take questions just right up here in the front. Thank you very much.